Lucy's friend slept over last night. I overheard the two little girls swearing friendship till death us do part. And at that moment, I remembered placing my cheek on Rachel's when I said goodbye and moved back to Evanston to be with Ben. It was painful to leave my husband Jack because I'd had dreams of a happy family with him. But in a deeper way, perhaps because the love between a woman and her husband is so complicated and friendship can have an uncomplicated purity, it was more painful to me to leave Rachel. She lived about 1 month more. Back from New Hampshire, Lucy is in Ellison Bay with us now. We drove up late last night, painful crying jags for her at least half the way up. "I want my daddy," she cried, hugging the bear he gave her in one arm. It is so painful to see her sad, to just be with her sadness. But after I got in the back seat with her and she had both little cats in one arm, she chattered nonstop and then abruptly fell asleep and slept for the rest of the trip. It was wonderful arriving in the black night, a new view of the peninsula, the amazing moon hanging huge and very yellow over the orchards and farms. It's good to have our girl back. Both Ben and I felt high anxiety yesterday, facing driving to the airport, then the long drive back up here with the two cats in the car. Today is for our recuperation. We, like mother cats, will be sniffing our kitten, reclaiming her as our own. Moods change so. Dysphoria, one of the official psychological terms for sadness. "I can't stand the way I look," I said to myself. But Lucy is there. She hears me, and I need to watch what I say after looking in the car mirror. Do I really think I must look, be beautiful? That I'm not worthy of notice unless I am beautiful? I recall the kinds of advice about appearance that were very common when I was growing up. A book about charm with chapters on how to dress, the expression you should have on your face, your posture, the tone of your voice, how to take off a coat, how to be graceful, when you should and shouldn't laugh, your skin, your hair, your makeup, your perfume. Always, always advised to be aware of the eye of the beholder. Helena Rubinstein, one of the women who began the whole cosmetic industry, even actually said that for women, beauty is a duty. In 9 years, when Lucy is 18 and I'm 51, she'll have youth and beauty, and I will have, I hope, 51 years behind me, and my looking glass days will be over. A woman dare not at any age be dependent on her sense of her looks for self-worth. But we girls are so vulnerable to it. Lucy said of her father's new wife, who has had a baby, "She looks more like a mom now, kind of friendly and tired out. She's still pretty, but in a different way." And Lucy comments on how I look like the at-home mom sometimes, and other times the going-to-work mom. She likes the at-home mom best. But beauty aside, on what can I rely for self-esteem, for feelings of usefulness and worth? A basic conviction not only that I am lovable, but also that I am capable of loving. My stomach is eating itself up and I cannot sleep or calm myself down. After months of real troubles, Matt came in at 4:20 a.m. I prayed to a higher power, our mother or parent. I've tried to do my best at stewardship of Matt. I know I've made some big mistakes, but I've done my best to rectify them. I've tried to be loving, fair, and encouraging, taking care of his body and mind to the best of my ability. He is not my possession, and I am not the only person in his life. Please let others help him when he needs help. He has to make his own decisions and live his own life. I have power over what I will do, not what he will do. Help me decide what my limits are. 4:20 a.m. is way past them. And let go of the rest of it. I don't know how to let go. Help me learn. Keep me in the present. For as AA says, the past can be depression and the future can be fear. Matt leaves tomorrow for college, and I'm all mixed up with feelings. So is he. When I was scouring the closet looking for towels for him to take, I suddenly realized he's leaving, felt it, and went downstairs to say it to him. He was feeling it too, and we embraced and both cried. He was trembling and sweaty. His young body heat is twice my middle-aged one, burning much hotter than Lucy's too. And we just held on for a few minutes. I think of my own college-bound journey at 17, and jumbled memories like a box full of old photos collide in me. Matt's purple-stained juice glasses after school, his whole childhood and youth gone by. This is Matt's 18th birthday, and I cannot sleep. It did not feel good to talk to him on the phone at college. His voice is different. He sounds free. I didn't know that his leaving meant he would be placing himself outside our whole context, that the break would be so big. I woke on this morning of his 18th birthday to a dream of trying vainly to reattach Big Matt, as he is today, to an umbilical cord which was too long and thin and no longer necessary, was in fact ridiculous. So maybe I did know. I feel old and tired. Lucy said of my comment about Matt sounding free, "It's like he was in a forest before, and now he's out in the open." Then she put her head on my shoulder. For now, she still wants to stay in the forest, for which I'm grateful. In Ellison Bay, our friend Roland came yesterday and adds to our pleasure of being here. He's napping on a lawn chair under a cotton blanket inside our backyard blue screen tent. Last night, we were listening to him talk about his little son's death many years ago. He said that he can't believe that life itself is bad or unjust because so many people have loved him, beginning with his mother. I wish that I could have had that certainty of being loved. But his grief rose up still, and he said, "I don't think I can talk about this anymore." Roland left very early. I could feel his tread shaking our whole small cottage. It's overcast and cold. We had talked more about his grief over his child and this depression I am in the midst of. I said it seemed his feeling was pure, a pure sadness, whereas this depression is confusing, full of self-dislike and regrets, and is unintelligible and frightening to others, like Ben, who do not understand it. I can talk about the depression to the psychiatrist I'm seeing, who is prescribing antidepressants, but not really to Ben. I didn't say all that. I wanted to, but Roland moved me when he recited a poem from memory, and I could hardly speak at all. I feel left out when he and Ben speak of their poems and share their work. But I remember from the book on depression that your worth is not dependent on what you do. But I don't know if it's worth that's the issue, or the feeling that I haven't written what I hoped to, that after all, we three met at the writers' conference, but as yet, I have little to show for it. Some short stories I haven't published, my New Hampshire newspaper series about child abuse, my feature stories, and unpublished book manuscript about the impact of miscarriage, and many diaries. Roland and Ben's poems present their experiences and deep feelings, whereas my feelings remain private, disclosed to only a few. But Roland read the introduction I wrote to an anthology of essays, and he clapped. He believes in me. Ben does too, but it helps to also have that belief come from another friend who is a writer. Roland is a wonderful old beat-up briefcase to hold his work. I brought mine in a loose pile, or maybe diary writing is my main writing work. My work as a social worker, a therapist, is to listen. One of my social work clients said to me when I asked her what she had hoped for in her marriage, somebody to listen. There is a kind of beauty in my work at times that makes me believe it's worthwhile. It's as if I am holding my heat close to someone else and helping them to melt the pain that has caused them to freeze inside. Today, I will take a vigorous walk for the sake of my neurotransmitters. I will take my little orange pills tonight and go to sleep. Sometimes it feels as though all I have added to a day is my own weight, as if the whole world is alive except me. The pace of life here in Ellison Bay is so different from the city. Part of it is simply feeling safe physically, not worried about locks or where other people are. A relaxed and comfortable unity between inside and outside, much more connection to the natural world and its pleasures. The sound of leaves when the breeze quickens, the sounds of birds, certainly, the odor of the air itself and of blossoms, the warmth of the sun, all seems orderly and unhurried. I imagine 12 months of it could be tedious, but for me now, it's like water for a great thirst. A few hours after I fell asleep last night, I dreamt that I had a bird's eye view of Earth, that I was in a kind of heaven, which was awesomely beautiful and peaceful. I realized that the people below me, the mortals, didn't need to be so worried about everything, including death, because this was the beautiful place they'd be going to, and they'd understand everything. I'm in the blue screen tent. A new bird I haven't heard before sings, "Peabody, Peabody," and I'm drinking my morning coffee in here. The cats are sitting motionless in the upstairs windows like bookends. Last night we went to Bailey's Harbor for the movie theater, a damp World War II tin building, musty smelling like a child's rubber boots. The movie was Harrison Ford in one of his adventure films, like a cartoon except for the number of deaths and the amount of blood. It was odd to come out of the theater and find ourselves in Bailey's Harbor, the lake lying still and dark blue across the street, the stars overhead. Driving home, Ben said he felt a little scared of how empty the place was. "Where is everybody?" he said. I was happy to hear him admit such a mood, because sometimes it seems I'm alone with my anxieties. While one of the pleasures here is feeling safe, because there isn't that city tension constantly with you, the distance between people, as Ben put it, on some roads and in the countryside, feels too great. "If I yelled at home, a neighbor would hear me," he said, "but not on this road." We felt even a little homesick driving through the dark country. Then we went shortly to bed. The cats were unhappy in my study, so I let them out. I heard a big thunk as I was falling asleep. This morning I found that heavy glass jug I'd bought at a secondhand store, unbroken, on the floor. Chasing after bugs, they'd been leaping wildly all around. Happy quiet days, writing. Though at 4 p.m. yesterday, I felt suddenly sick of the quiet and the slow pace, and we went out. I got a letter from Lucy at camp. She'd made me a bracelet. "I hope you like it, Mom," and told of being allowed by her counselor to spot the water skiers. And though there's, "I'm having a great time here at camp," still there's also, "I miss you very much," and "I'm making new friends, but I miss the old ones." Her letter ended with, "I love you," and in cursive writing, her full name and middle initial. It's an intense pleasure to get mail here. I go across the road with quickened pulse to the little white frame one-story post office and stand at the small counter. I ask the very round postmistress, she looks like Mrs. Tiggywinkle, a creature from the Beatrix Potter book, if we have any mail. She'll glance at me and say, "Nothing today," if we don't. But if we do, she turns toward the corner where they hold general delivery mail, and I feel as if there's been a tug on a fishing line. No friendly small talk from her, though. We are from away, as people say up here about those of us who are not natives, and especially those of us from Illinois. So far, we've had two letters from Lucy. We've written her every day, so I hope she's also getting pleasure from receiving mail. I'm sitting in a folding chair in the little shabby laundry room whose walls I've just painted in the midst of a mess of paintbrushes and newspaper and rags on the floor. I decided to fix up this room and use it as a study because it has two windows, the most light, and I can hear the bird songs. I'm up early to get the most enjoyment out of the day. Both cats followed me in, and the boy cat leaps up on top of the small water heater, then purrs. The girl cat sits neatly on the seat of the stool under the window. She has wrapped her tail around her feet and watches the morning. From the north window in this room, I see only low branches of spruce, and at this hour, sunlight splashing through them as if someone had thrown a bucket of light. The morning dove calls. Robins are loud, the optimists of birds, I told Ben. The feeling in this room is just what I hoped it would be, peaceful, reflective, and close to the outdoors. I began to write a story. Kate turned the key and carefully pushed open the door, peering into the quiet, darkened waiting room of Old Oaks Hospital Mental Health Center. She was early to work, a good hour and a half before the secretarial staff was due to open the office, because she was feeling worried about one particular client. She'd dreamt about her the night before and wanted to be here early, alone in the quiet and dimness, so that she could go over the client's chart. Her own office was immediately off the large waiting room, with its struggling potted plants and racks of magazines, its curved plastic couches. The shape of the room was like the prow of a ship, because these offices had been squeezed into a new part of the hospital building. As a result, the brown formica curved reception desk area made her think of a large piano bar, an incongruous image for a mental health center, since all of the people who came here week after week were suffering in one way or another, hardly coming to be entertained by piano music, much less to drink. The blind man with his seeing eye dog, the street people who wandered in, ragged and dirty with hunted-looking eyes, the small children accompanying their mothers who could afford no babysitters with whom to leave them. It continually surprised Kate how even a place like this, that only existed to help people, could be such a nest of conflict, jostling for power, bureaucratic hurdles, and procrastination. She had been here 2 years before she and her colleague had been able to commit their director to designating space for children and ordering the small table and chairs, the black, brown, and white doll families that reflected the center's clients, the term that social workers preferred to the psychiatrist's term, patients. Kate glanced with satisfaction at the children's play area that she and another staff therapist had managed to put together. Though generous in other ways, the director balked at the prices of the children's items. He'd circled the prices of several things in the catalog with a question mark by them, put the catalog back in her mailbox in the main office. It had taken another month, another staff meeting, to get approval to spend the money. Kate and her colleague, her closest ally and friend there, had argued that not having a children's area was unwelcoming to the population they were supposed to be serving. What were the mothers to do with their children while they had their sessions with their therapists? And not having chairs that fit children's small bodies or toys to play with conveyed the message that children were not important. The boy cat is lying down now, asleep atop the warm water heater. Both cats, still young, show evidence of their traumatic kittenhood before they were rescued by the shelter where I found them. The boy cat's always anxious when I leave a room and he follows me. The girl has achieved some serenity, but in my depressed hours, it is a comfort when the boy cat seeks me out, comes close to me, and, almost like a friend, reaches out an orange and white front paw to touch me. Lucy's with us up here now. Before sleep, she called out, "When they cut the heads off people, like in the old days, what do they do for a funeral?" And, "I wonder what it would be like to sit in the electric chair." What awful thoughts for a 10-year-old. She still smells like Lucy, her neck like a kind of fruity, hard apricot. Her whole suntan self looks really preteen now, not like a little girl. While I am declining, she is maturing and ripening. "I feel awful. I quarreled with Ben, and though I cleaned the cottage and took Lucy out to lunch and to get a video, I have cabin fever." Then Jack called from New Hampshire, a quick, hostile interchange resulting in my tears and my trembling as I hung up the phone. Lucy came in to say, "So you're mad at both your husbands?" I dreamt I was in some battle that nobody would count as a war, but one could be dead nonetheless. And Ben dreamt I had a bad twin who would kill me. He was running around trying to save my life, was very worried about me. People were trying to convince him the good twin had never existed, but he had proof of it, witnesses of the life we'd had together. I think the bad twin is this depression of mine. I was just waking up from a nap when Ben told me he'd folded up the screen tent and put it away. He said, all I could think of was Roland and you and me, and they're having drinks and crackers and cheese. I replied, you folded him up with it. Back at home, in our warm living room with its deep green rug that conceals the whole beat-up pine floor so that it might be a grassy clearing in a forest, in front of the decorated Christmas tree, I'm reading in the newspaper about Romania. Lucy is holding the boy cat, who stretches its soft furry paw to pat her face. In the forest in Romania, I read, soldiers ripped open the belly of a pregnant woman. Lucy is chattering to me and to the cat, who's blinking at the tree lights, at the pile of shining gifts. In Timișoara, a woman doctor bathed patients with water in her bare hands because soap and washcloths were unavailable. Although usually I only write in the morning, I go to get my diary so I can write that down. My daughter and I are here, and not in the forest, but some other mother is, and some other daughter. Are you writing in your diary? Lucy asks. Yes, I answer. I'm writing about how terrible and wonderful people are. I tell her, not about the pregnant woman, but of soldiers killing people and the doctor's hands. Lucy strokes the cat's silky fur. Why do the soldiers kill people? She asks. I answer, because they're cruel, because they hate. She's quiet for a moment. Just like the girls at school, she says. Let's be mean to her, the girls had decided when she'd said something they didn't like. They wrote her a letter telling why they hated her and put it into her locker. She'd cried and cried 2 nights ago from this.